Blog Talk Radio.
So, more than all of the exports of the United States and more than the national budget of Canada, this reveals that we have made some strides in this area. But probably more than anything else, and you've read about it so much here and all over the world, I'm sure, we have noticed a gradual decline, even demise, of the system of racial segregation. Now, the legal history of racial segregation had its beginning in 1896. Many people feel that racial segregation has been a reality in the United States a long, long time. But the fact is that this was a rather recent phenomenon in our country, just a little better than 60 years old. And it had its legal beginning with a decision known as the Plessy versus Ferguson decision, which said in substance that separate but equal facilities could exist, and it made the doctrine of separate but equal the law of the land. We all know what happened as a result of the old Plessy doctrine. That was always the strict enforcement of the separate without the slightest intention to abide by the equal. The Negro ended up being plunged into the abyss of exploitation, where he experienced the bleakness of nagging injustice. But then something marvelous happened. Supreme Court of Washington in 1954 examined the legal body of segregation and on May 17th of that year pronounced the Constitution of the day. It said in substance that the old Plessy doctrine must go, that separate facilities are inherently unequal, and that to segregate a child on the basis of his race is to deny that child equal protection of the law. So we've seen many changes since that momentous decision was rendered in 1954. It came as a great beacon light of hope to millions of disinherited people all over our nation. Then something else happened, which brought joy to all of our hearts. It happened this year. It was last year after the struggle in Birmingham, Alabama. The late President Kennedy came to realize that there was a basic issue that our country had to grapple with a sense of concern and a sense of immediacy. He made a great speech a few days before. Well, it was really on the same day that the University of Alabama was to be integrated, and Governor Wallace stood in the door and tried to block that integration. And Mr. Kennedy had to have the National Guard federalized. He stood before the nation and said in eloquent terms, the problem we face in the area of civil rights is not merely a political issue. It is not merely an economic issue. It is at bottom a moral issue. It is as old as the scriptures and as modern as the Constitution. It is a question of whether we will treat our Negro brothers as we ourselves would like to be treated. And on the heels of that great speech, he went and recommended to the Congress of our nation the most comprehensive civil rights bill ever recommended by any president of our great nation. After many months of battle for a period, we got a little tired of that. You know, there are some men in our country who like to talk a lot. Maybe you read about the filibuster, and you know they get bogged down in the paralysis of analysis, and they will just go on and on and on, and they wanted to talk that bill to death. President Lyndon Johnson got to work. He started calling congressmen and senators in. He started meeting day in and day out with influential people in the country, making it clear that that bill had to pass as a tribute to the late President Kennedy, but also as a tribute to the greatness of the country. as an expression of its dedication to the American dream. And it was that great day last summer that that bill came into being. It was on July 2nd that Mr. Johnson signed that bill, and it became the law of the land. So in America now, we have a civil rights bill, and I'm happy to report to you that by law, that bill is being implemented in communities all across the South. We have seen some surprising levels of compliance, even in some communities in the state of Mississippi. And wherever you can find anything right in Mississippi, things are getting better.
The Senate again speaking in London, December 7th, 1964. We'll return to the state after the break.
You're listening to Black Noise Radio.
You never forget the fact that just this summer, three civil rights workers were brutally murdered near Philadelphia, Mississippi. All of this reveals to us that we have not achieved the level of brotherhood. We have not achieved the brotherhood that we need and that we must have in our nation. We still have a long, long way to go. I mentioned voter registration and the fact that we have been able to add about 800,000 new registered voters in the last two or three years, the fact that it's over 2 million now, I guess that sounded like real progress, and it does represent some progress. But let me give you the other side. That is the fact that there are still more than 10 million Negroes living in the southern part of the United States, and some 6 million the Negroes living in the southern part of the United States are of voting age. And yet, million are registered. This means that 4 million remain unregistered. Not merely because they are apathetic, not because they are complacent. This may be true of some few, because all types of conniving methods are still being used to keep Negroes from becoming registered voters. Complex literacy tests are given, which make it almost impossible for anybody to pass a test, even if he has a PhD degree in any field or a law degree from the best law schools of the world. Actual economic reprisals are often taken out against Negroes who seek to register and vote in some of the Black Belt counties of Mississippi and Alabama and other places. Then some are actually faced with physical violence and sometimes physical death. This reveals that we have a great deal that must be done in this area. I mentioned economic justice, and I'm sure that figure, $28 billion, sounds very large. That's a lot of money. And I must go on and give you the other side, if I'm to be honest about the picture. That is the fact that 42% of the Negro families of the United States still earn less than $2,000 a year, while just 16% of the white families earn less than $2,000 a year. 21% of the Negro families of America earn less than $1,000 a year, while just 5% of the white families earn less than $1,000 a year. Then we face the fact that 88% of the Negro families of America earn less than $5,000 a year, while just 58% of the white families earn less than $5,000 a year. So we can see that that is still a great gulf between the haves, so to speak, and the have-nots. If America is to continue to grow and progress and develop, move on toward its greatness, this problem must be solved. Now, this economic problem is getting more serious because of the forces alive in our world. For many years, Negroes were denied adequate educational opportunities. For many years, Negroes were even denied apprenticeship training. So the forces of labor and industry so often discriminated against Negroes. This meant the Negro ended up being limited by and large to unskilled and semi-skilled labor. Now, because of the forces of automation and cybernation that are now passing away. So the Negro wakes up in a city like Detroit, Michigan, discovers that he is 28% of the population and about 72% of the unemployed. Now, in order to grapple with that problem, our federal government will have to develop massive retraining programs, massive public works programs, so that automation can be a blessing, as it must be, to our society and not a curse. Then the other thing, when we think of this economic problem, we must think of the fact that that is nothing more dangerous than to build a society with a segment in that society which feels that it has no stake in the society. Nothing more dangerous than to build a society with a number of people who see life as little more than a long and desolate corridor with no exit sign. They end up with despair because they have no jobs, because they can't educate their children, because they can't live in a nice home, because they can't have adequate health facilities. We always hear of the various reasons why and the various myths concerning integration and why integration shouldn't come into being. Most people who argue against integration at this point often say, well, if you integrate public schools, for instance, you will pull the white race back a generation. They like to talk about the cultural lag in the Negro community. And then they go on to say, now, you know, the Negro is a criminal and he has the highest crime rate. Any city that you can find in the United States, and the arguments go on ad infinitum why integration should have come into being. But I think there's an answer to that. That is that the values, cultural lag in the Negro community, that certainly is. This lag is
your bros are sleeping, your skull t-shirt, your
You are still listening to Black Noise Radio, and we're going to get back to Martin Luther King.
We are about past the day of legal segregation. We have about ended de jure segregation, where the laws of the nation or of a particular state can uphold it because of the civil rights bill and the Supreme Court's decision and other things. We have passed the day when the Negro can't eat at a lunch counter, with the exception of a few isolated situations, or the Negro can't check in a motel or a hotel. We are past the passing that day. But that is another form of segregation coming up. It is coming up through housing discrimination, joblessness, and the de facto segregation in the public school. And so the ghettoized conditions that exist make for many problems, that it makes for a hardcore de facto segregation that we must grapple with on a day-to-day basis. So this is a problem that we face, and this is the problem that we are forced to deal with. And we are going to deal with it in a determined way. I'm absolutely convinced that segregation is on its deathbed, and those who represent it, whether they be in the United States or whether they be in London, England, the system is on its deathbed. But certainly we all know that if democracy is to live in any nation, segregation must die. And as I've tried to say all over America, we've got to get rid of segregation, not merely because it will help our image, it certainly will help our image in the world. We've got to get rid of segregation, not merely because it will appeal to Asian and African peoples, and this certainly will be helpful, this is important. But in the final analysis, racial discrimination must be uprooted from American society and from every society, because it is morally wrong. So it is necessary to go all out and develop massive action programs to get rid of racial segregation. Now, I would like to mention one or two ideas that circulate in our society, and they probably circulate in your society and all over the world, that keep us from developing the kind of action programs necessary to get rid of discrimination and segregation. One is what I refer to as the myth of time. There are those individuals who argue that only time can solve the problem of racial injustice. Use time much more effectively than the forces of goodwill. We may have to repent in this generation, not merely for the vitriolic words and the violent actions of the bad people, but for the appalling silence and indifference of the good people who sit around saying, "We are." Somewhere along the way, it is necessary to see that human progress never rolls down the field of inevitability. It comes through the tireless efforts and the persistent work of dedicated individuals who are willing to be co-workers with God, and without this hard work, time itself becomes an ally of the primitive forces of social stagnation. So we must help time. We must realize that the time is always right to do right. This is so vital. This is so necessary. Now, the other myth that gets around a great deal in our nation, and I'm sure in other nations of the world, is the idea that you can't solve the problems in the realm of human relations through legislation. You can't solve the housing problem and the job problem, all of these other problems, through legislation. You've got to change the heart. We had a presidential candidate just recently who spoke about this a great deal, and I think Mr. Goldwater sincerely believed that you couldn't do anything through legislation, because he voted against everything in the Senate, including the civil rights bill. And he said all over the nation throughout the election that we don't need legislation, that legislation can't deal with this problem. But he was nice enough to say that you've got to change the heart Now, I wonder if he's going halfway with Brother Goldwater at that point. I think he's right. If we're going to get this problem solved in America, all over the world, ultimately, people must change their hearts where they have prejudices. If we're going to solve the problems facing mankind, I would be the first to say that every white person must look down deep within, remove every prejudice that may be there, and come to see that the Negro, the colored peoples generally must be treated right, not merely because the law says it, but because it is right and because it is natural. I agree with this 100%. And I'm sure that if the problem is to be solved, men must be obedient not merely to that which can be enforced by the law, but they must rise to the majestic heights of being obedient to the unenforceable. But after saying all of that, I must go on to the other side, where I must leave Mr. Goldwater and others who believe the legislation has no place. It may be true that you can't legislate integration, but you can legislate desegregation. It may be true that morality cannot be legislated, but behavior can be regulated. It may be true that the law can't change the heart, but it can restrain the heartless. It may be true that the law can make a man lovely, but it can restrain him politically, and I think that's pretty important also.
Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. speaking in London on December 7th, 1964.
The Asians, and I see a lot of the brothers and sisters out here. There's